From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, Catherine Deneuve talks about her film career. She starred in The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, Repulsion, and Belle du Jour. Her new film, Thieves, is about to open. Also, we listened to a 1988 interview with John Lithgow. Before starring in the sitcom Third Rock from the Sun, he was in the movies The World According to Garp, Terms of Endearment, and The Pelican Brief. Film critic John Powers reviews the new film Shine, and we remember astronomer Carl Sagan, who died today of pneumonia after a two-year battle with bone marrow disease. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Clinton is expected momentarily to make an announcement about his new cabinet. Reports are that Transportation Secretary Federico Pena will be asked to stay on, but as Secretary of Energy. The president is also expected to announce that Federal Highway Administration Chief Rodney Slater will be nominated to replace Pena, and that Alexis Herman, now a White House aide, will be nominated to head the Labor Department. President Clinton's spokesman Mike McCurry said today the Justice Department will work to overturn California's Proposition 209. The measure, approved last month, outlaws affirmative action. McCurry said the Justice Department has concluded that it is unconstitutional and will back legal action to throw it out. Peruvian rebels who are into their third day of holding hostages at the Japanese ambassador's residence in Lima are demanding some necessities be restored to the building. This follows the Peruvian president's rejection of the rebels' demand to release their comrades from jail. The BBC's Robert Plummer reports from Lima.
Roughly 400 people are still inside the building, including diplomats, politicians, and prominent Japanese businessmen. There were signs of activity inside the building during the morning when hostages appeared at a side window holding up notices in Japanese. The message turned out to be a request for an interview with the Japanese television network NHK. The network has agreed to speak to them, but it's unlikely that police will allow the Japanese journalists to enter the building. In their handwritten note, the hostages also called for electric power, telephones, and running water to be restored to the residents. Amid concern for the physical and mental health of the hostages, who have now spent 3 nights under armed guard, the Red Cross has said it will visit them twice a day to monitor their condition and provide further much-needed supplies of food and water. Robert Plummer, Lima.
Noted astronomer Carl Sagan died today in Seattle of pneumonia after a two-year bout with bone marrow disease. He was 62. Ken Vincent of member station KUOW reports from Seattle.
Occasionally throughout his career, Carl Sagan was criticized by his contemporaries for simplifying science for the masses. In 1980, Sagan became known to millions hosting Cosmos, one of public TV's most watched series, helping to popularize astronomy and the phrase billions and billions, the quantifier that became synonymous with Sagan's identity as a popular figure. Sagan also had a long distinguished career as a research scientist. In his early 20s, Sagan was one of the first to deduce that the planet Venus was a fiery, foreboding environment, and that Mars's red color is the result of the Martian weather, not terrain. Sagan had been receiving treatment for bone marrow disease at Seattle's Hutchinson Cancer Research Center for the past couple of years. For National Public Radio, I'm Ken Vincent in Seattle.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 15.76 points at 6489.78. The Nasdaq is down 6.64 points at 1289.22. This is National Public Radio News. Iraq claims it's foiled a sabotage and espionage ring working for the CIA. The official Iraqi news agency reports that those arrested gave confessions, which will be broadcast tonight on Iraqi television. The report did not say how many people were arrested or give any other details on the alleged ring. According to the latest police department statistics, crime in New York City has fallen for the third straight year to its lowest level in 30 years. As Dick Hinchcliffe of member station WNYC reports, New York City's mayor is taking credit for the decline, but other factors may be part of the story.
The numbers are staggering. Preliminary police department records reveal crime is down 16% this year and nearly 50% over the past 4 years. Most impressive is that major crimes like murder, rape, robbery, and assault continue to plummet, with New York City on pace to record fewer than 1,000 homicides for the first time since 1968. Republican Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, running strong in the polls a year before an expected bid for re-election, calls the crime drop really remarkable. He credits new policing strategies, including computerized projections of places where crime is likely to occur. But others say social factors are also at work. The crack cocaine epidemic has subsided. Demographic changes mean fewer young men prone to crime. And with tougher laws, hardened criminals are doing more time behind bars. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchcliffe in New York.
U.S. lawyers won't be allowed to take part in the Bosnian War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. There are 16 lawyers and investigators from the U.S. participating in the investigation and prosecution of those accused of committing atrocities in the Bosnian conflict. Their salaries are being paid by the U.S., but the U.S. is also supposed to pay an additional 13% to defray the tribunal's expenses. The U.S. won't pay, so the U.S. personnel will have to leave. The U.S. is also withholding U.N. dues and other payments worth more than $1.3 billion. I'm Noor Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Catherine Deneuve is not only an actress, she's an icon. She's been called one of the most remarkably beautiful actresses of our time. Earlier this week, she was at the bedside of her daughter's father, Marcello Mastroianni, as he died. Deneuve started her career in the early 60s and soon won international recognition for her performances in The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, Belle du Jour, and Repulsion. More recently, she starred in The Last Metro, Andochine, which won her Best Actress Award in France, and Ma Saison Préférée, directed by André Téchiné. Téchiné also directed her new film Thieves, or Les Voleurs. It opens in New York and L.A. Christmas Day and around the country early next year. The film is an erotic psychological thriller about a detective investigating the murder of his brother. The detective becomes lovers with a thief, a woman who worked with the brother, but this woman has another lover, a philosophy professor, played by Catherine Deneuve. I spoke with her last October when the film played at the New York Film Festival and asked what was new for her in this role.
To be in love with a woman. To be in love with a woman. It's very clear in the film that Mary, the character I play, is a woman who has married and has children. And she meets that girl and she falls in love with her. That's the first experience. That was something I was, you know, not too familiar with. But the way it's written in the film is something very, very subtle. And actually, I didn't find any difference to feeling in love with a girl or with a boy, because the way she loves that girl is a very total and very large love affectionate, you know, even if it's very physical as well, not in the film, but what you feel the relation between the two is physical as well.
I think a lot of American actors and actresses are afraid to take on the roles of gays or lesbians in movies.
I can understand.
Did you have any concerns?
No, but I'm not American.
Do you think it's different in France than in America?
Yes, very.
What's the difference?
I think it's a question of religion and education. I think in America, people allow themselves a lot of things, but in the same time, they're very, I don't know how you say, pudibond. I mean,
That America is more moralistic?
Yes, very much on private life and sexual life. I mean, it's incredible to see to which level can a private life of someone public to bring him and destroy his life. I think that's something that cannot happen in Europe.
Well, you've had two children out of wedlock, each with other people in the film world. And I'm wondering, I mean, were the French ever moralistic about that?
As far as I'm concerned,
mm-hmm.
No. You can have a public life and have a private life. It's something that's very possible in Europe. I mean, when you are interviewed, you know, you're not supposed. There is a very strong law in France also to protect private life in public matters. You are not supposed to be taken picture of or interviewed without your consentment, or even taken in picture without your consentment and then published, printed in magazines. That's a very strong law, and you can really fight even sue magazines that would do that. I don't think there is anything like that in America. Which means you have to be very careful all the time, which means also, I suppose, you have to lie, which is something I would hate to have to do for as far as my private life is concerned.
That's an interesting point. You're saying that in America, people in public life are forced to lie because the truth would be unacceptable.
Absolutely. On private life, yes. On private matters, yes.
You said it wasn't until Umbrellas of Cherbourg in 1964 that you started taking acting seriously. What was it about that film that made you serious about acting?
It's not about the film. It's about the director. Mm-hmm. Because
Jacques Demy,
yes, he's a very, was a very important director. And it was very important for me to meet someone like that so young. He gave me confidence and he sort of made me look at things in a different way. I mean, I had done very few films before to meet him, and I couldn't imagine, you know, it could be like that. And it was really like a revelation. It was something I would have never think of. And after that, it really was very different for me.
Could you say what it was about his approach to making movies that you found so new and exciting and different?
I suppose first it's because his personality, you know, and his way of seeing films and directing and doing very long shots, a great, very long traveling, and that was something that I was not used to, you know. And also the sense he had of color and using actors, and he was talking, you know, about what he was doing. That's something he wanted to share with us. And he was he had a lot of confidence in me, which I didn't have. And that really helped me a lot. I realized that if a director really wants you and is very strong and has a good personality and is very positive, it can bring you, to me, it was really like an incredible discovery.
I love this film. It was restored and recently re-released.
Yes,
it's a
beautiful,
wonderful film.
Beautiful new copy.
Now, all the dialogue is sung in the movie, and all the actors' voices are dubbed by professional singers. When did you find out that you weren't going to be using your own voice in the movie?
From the beginning, because it was written, you know, as an opera, and no way that the music of Michel Legrand could be sung by an actor that would work for a few months. And it was already a very difficult work to have to learn by heart completely the film, so we could shoot the film and be completely lip-sync. That was very difficult. And that was enough of a difficulty for two young actors like me and Nino Castelnuovo, my partner.
I'm thinking of how hard it must be to give such a convincing performance when one of your greatest tools, your voice, can't be used.
Yes, but, you know, it was a musical. So when you have to do it, and first I was, you know, I was not even 20 years old, so I didn't really realize that. I had very little experience. And when I had to learn the music with the words, you know, I was so taken by the music. And even when you have to shoot, you have to really sing loud. You cannot just open your mouth, you know, as if you were just, you know, trying to be just in lip sync. I mean, you really have to sing. It's not your voice that you hear. But I remember I had the impression that I was really singing. And I thought, you know, that doing a film, you have to do it for the best. And the fact it was not me, but a singer, seemed normal to have a professional for the... It's a frustration afterwards, a long time afterwards. But when I did it and when we did the film, it was absolutely fine for me. And I didn't think, you know, that what a shame is not going to be my voice and I feel so frustrated, or I didn't feel like that at all. Maybe today, yes, I wouldn't do it because I have the impression that my voice is more known because I've been doing many films and people know my voice. But at the time, you know, it was to me a normal thing, you know, to have a professional singer. And anyway, it's very, very difficult to sing Michel Legrand. Very difficult.
I just want to ask you one question about the ending. This is a movie about a young couple who are deeply in love, but they're separated when he's sent off to the military. And then she ends up being pregnant. And because she doesn't hear from him a lot, she assumes he's left her. And she ends up marrying somebody else. He comes back, is heartbroken, and later marries somebody else. What do you think of the ending? Do you think that they're better off with the people who they married than with each other?
I don't know. That's impossible to know. What I can think of, it's a very sad ending for me because it's a very... obviously, they seem to be, you know, happy, I don't know, but they seem to be fine, you know, with the lives they have. But when you've seen the film, and for the audience, I suppose, to the desire, you know, to get those two people together again, because it was such a strong and such an emotional love story that you feel like crying, because that's life, you know. It's very unfair. Actually, the film is not such a, it's not like a fairy tale, like some people said, you know, because she's pregnant. Her mother pushes her to marry another man because she's pregnant, and it's no question she's not going to keep the child, and no question that she's going to be by herself. And her mother pushes her in the arm of someone very fine, quite rich, you know. I mean, sort of conventional thing that make me cry. Even today.
Catherine Deneuve is my guest, and she's starring in the new movie, Thieves. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Catherine Deneuve. In 1967, you made Belle du Jour, directed by Louis Buñuel. Now, this movie has also recently been restored. It's an interesting contrast to Umbrellas of Cherbourg. In Umbrellas, you played somebody very young and very naive. In Belle du Jour, you're a young married woman, but
you, quite naive as well.
Okay, but naive in a different way. Because,
yes, yeah. But naive in a way.
Yeah, you can't be sexually satisfied within the marriage, so you become a prostitute at a very high-priced brothel.
Call girl, yes.
Yeah, and you're there during the day, and your husband doesn't know about it. Mm-hmm. And the movie combines the reality of your married life, the brothel life, with all of these fantasy scenes. What was Buñuel's approach to directing you in this role?
Very little. Very, very little. The script was so, you know, really very heavy on the matter, so, and Buñuel didn't like much to give psychological explanations to actors. I remember to have had difficulties, you know, sometimes, because also the producer were very strong, and Buñuel was in Paris living in a hotel, and I wouldn't see him much, you know, outside of work, and he wouldn't let me go and see the rushes, the delis, you know. It was a little, sometimes it has been difficult. It was a difficult shooting sometimes. My remember of him is much better when we did Tristana, you know, 2 years later in Spain, because that was a much better experience for me as an actress with him. But Belle du Jour was a difficult subject anyway to do.
Yes, well, I'm wondering if in Belle du Jour, if the woman's sexual fantasies of humiliation made any sense to you.
Yes, it makes sense because fantasies are made, you know, to it's like a phantasm. You're supposed to be, you imagine yourself in a situation that you might never leave, but that you need because it gives you some excitement or some. And actually, in Belle du Jour, they are very, all the situation are very classical situation that men and women think of, you know, sometimes in a love affair. It's something very. And when I saw Belle du Jour again, that I hadn't seen it for a very, very long time. I saw it again then in New York, in that very beautiful restored copy in New York. And I was quite surprised to see the sort of humor, you know, also that there was in the film, which I didn't feel that much at the time when I did the film. Maybe when I saw the film, but when I did the film, I didn't feel that much.
Now, the film critic David Thompson wrote this about you. He wrote, "Deneuve is a fantastic actress, her beauty a receptacle for any imagination, perhaps the greatest cool blonde, forever hinting at intimations of depravity." And what's your reaction to that?
I like that. I think it's better than any kind of, you know, nicer compliment about being. I think it's very intriguing, you know, to imagine someone being such a, like a deep volcano. You know, you don't know how far down, you know, you can fall. But in the same time, officially, when you look at that person, she seems, you know, very straightforward. Very, I find it very intriguing.
Yes,
I would like to meet the person he's talking about.
You feel very far from that, as Catherine Deneuve.
Well, I have the impression he's talking, of course, about someone else, you know, something between me, but mostly something about the character. And it's one of the films I've done, Belle du Jour, that followed me more than anything during all my life, because I did Belle du Jour in 69, and even today I can feel in some question of journalists the fact that Belle du Jour is something that people say I'm very related with, you know, as if I was, you know, partly, you know, very much that person.
What about repulsion, though? I'm sure people always ask you about your character as a sexually repressed woman going mad.
She's a schizophrenic. Yeah, she's a schizophrenic girl, and she's. But repulsion was very, very close to me in a way, because she was a very shy, very violent, deeply violent, but shy in the same time. And it's just because she was put in a certain kind of situation that sort of madness, you know, came out. Otherwise, you can imagine she could have followed very well for a very long time, living with her sister, probably getting married and having children, and nothing would have happened. Then, you know, there was something in her that went wrong, but because of the situation to be left alone for a weekend and her imagination, she had that little potential thing that became terrible, and she becomes, you know, what the film tells, you know, she becomes a criminal in the most violent way that... But also, I think in Repulsion, it's something I think people can identify with that woman. She's not a monster, you know. She's not doing that, you know, as a crude thing, just to be being cruel and wanting to kill. It's just something that she can't resist because she has fear of men, and she feels threatened.
Do you think that men and women relate to you differently on screen?
Well, I hope so. I mean, yes, because there is a difference between men and women. You know, I don't think they see male and female actors on screen the same way. But I think women quite sympathize with me. You know,
mm-hmm.
I don't think women sort of resent me as a sort of icy, dangerous blonde. No, I don't think that.
You know, I'm wondering if women relate to you even more now than in the early part of your career when you played more naive and very seductive women. Now there's a certain power that your characters have, or at least some of them have, or the
yes,
powerful characters the, have.
But, the powerful character that you can have, you know, that's the compensation of getting older, you know, is to have, you know, more mature parts with a character stronger and with more... but it's very difficult, it's true, for a young actress to find a very deep, very important, very touching, very warm, very very serious part. It's quite difficult to find everything in a part for a young actress. When you can think of a mature actress, I think there are certain age, you know, of life for an actress on screen. And there is the sort of what I was like in Ambulance of Cherbourg. You know, I was the young, romantic, idealistic girlfriend. Then there was, you know, the mature, younger, mature and responsible woman in Last Metro, film of France 1984. And there is today a touching woman that women can sympathize and identify with because I don't represent, you know, a sort of glamorous in a sort of... artificial aware person, so it's the evolution of a life of an actress, I think.
You did Chanel perfume ads for years. How did you feel about doing those ads?
Very well. I liked it very much. I'd worked with them, and I was very I sympathized very much with the people. I think that if you do publicity as I did, you know, it's not something I do just to sort of hide it and put it away as if it was something I do on the side. It's really something I like, publicity, and I did enjoy very much to work with Avedon when we did that commercial for a few years, and I worked with the people who were writing the script. I felt very confident with that.
And you,
something I like very much.
Do you still wear perfume?
Do I wear perfume?
Yeah.
Yes, of course I wear perfume every day, even in the country.
Really?
Yeah.
Does it give you pleasure to wear it?
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure it gives pleasure to others, but it gives me pleasure first at me to me as well.
In America, actresses start to feel shut out of films often by their mid-30s because they're no longer eligible for the glamour roles. Did you ever experience that in France?
No, because we are allowed to grow a little older in Europe, you know, not only in France but in Europe. I think there is a more attraction for a mature woman than there seems to be here, where everybody is so scared to get old and where people seem to be running so much after youth, which being an actress, you know, and growing up in age, you know, and in that profession, I can understand. But there is a sort of, to me, a foolish thing to try to escape in a wrong way, you know. I think you have to fight, you know, as much as you can, and try to stay in shape. But if you run against what you are, I think you can really become crazy.
In America, I think a lot of actresses and actors as well feel that plastic surgery becomes essential to their career after a certain age.
It goes with it. It goes with it. You know, it goes with running against time. In Europe, it's the same, but to another level, I suppose. I suppose it's not as many people do it, and it's not as evident. But people do it to a more reasonable level. I have the impression.
Has that been an issue for you?
An issue for me, what?
Plastic surgery.
What means to be an issue?
I guess it's my very polite way of asking if you've done it yourself, which you don't need to answer if you don't want to.
You know, it's something I always refuse to answer because I had the impression that to say no was like saying to other women, what you think, I haven't done it. I think it's rude to... But now I think it's very difficult not to say that... You know, that started, you know, a few years ago. I started to be asked, and I say, I won't answer that because I find it rude, as if, you know, women who have done it were in another world. And I feel I sympathize very much for people, you know, who feel they have to do it. But today, I mean, the question comes back so often, I have to say that, no, I have to say I didn't do it. And I didn't do it because, like a lot of people, you know, I think I would be scared for the moment. But I must say that I'm very reluctant to answer to that question because I feel like saying, you know, I'm in one, that part of the woman, and there is the other part. I don't like this idea that the one who have done it, you know, it's like being a, come on, it's like a...
You don't want to be passing judgment on them by saying that you haven't done it.
Good. That's the way I should have put it.
Catherine Deneuve. She stars in the new movie Thieves, or Les Voleurs. It opens in New York and Los Angeles on Christmas Day and opens in cities around the country early next year. Our interview was recorded last October when the film was presented at the New York Film Festival. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And here's music from the Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Mais je ne pourrai jamais vivre sans toi. Je ne pourrai pas, ne pars pas, j'en mourrai. Je te cacherai et je te garderai. Mais mon amour ne me quitte.
Ce n'est pas possible.
Je ne te quitterai pas.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from Ghosts of Mississippi, a Rob Reiner film, now at select theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up from the archives, a 1988 interview with John Lithgow, who's now starring in the sitcom Third Rock from the Sun. Film critic John Powers reviews Shine, and we remember astronomer Carl Sagan, who died today at the age of 62.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One leading Oscar contender for Best Picture this year is the Australian film Shine. Its star Jeffrey Rush has already been named Best Actor by both the New York and Los Angeles film critics. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
Have you ever gone to a movie and been astonished at how the people around you were responding? That happened to me at this year's Sundance Film Festival when I first saw the little Australian movie Shine. I sat through the picture, not unhappily, thinking it an extremely skillful version of a rather trite kind of story. Then the lights came up, and I discovered that I was surrounded by sobbing agents. Shine is loosely based on the true story of David Helfgott, an Australian piano prodigy whose whole life is a tug-of-war between genius and insanity. As a boy growing up in 50s Australia, David lives in a state of crushing emotional pressure, caught between the inner demon of his musical gift and the brutality of his father, Peter, who's played by fierce, pale-eyed Armin Mueller-Stahl. Peter spends years pushing David to shine as a pianist, then goes berserk when his son's prize-winning recitals mean he might actually leave home. By the time David finally escapes to London, the beleaguered young virtuoso is primed for madness. He cracks up on stage while performing Rachmaninoff's gaudy Concerto No. 3 and spends years in mental institutions. The David who emerges could be one of the sad, crazy people you see living on the street. A lurching, twitching, raincoat-wearing scarecrow who talks a kind of free associative scat. We live in an age in which bad parenting is used to explain almost everything. Shine glibly suggests that David's schizophrenia was caused by his father, a Jewish emigre who lost most of his relatives in the Holocaust and is obsessed with keeping his own family together, even if he has to destroy its members to do it. Father uses every trick in the book, from beatings to guilt trips. And when his son says that he plans to study in London, he pulls out all the stops.
I've been accepted into the Royal College of Music.
What do you think is going to happen to you in London? Here you go. You will never come back into this house again. You will never be anybody's son. The girls will lose their brother. If that's what you want, you want to destroy your family.
I'm sorry.
David, if you love me, you will stop this nonsense. You will not step out that door. David, here you go. You will be punished for the rest of your life, my David. Don't go.
But if David's life is fraught with pain, Shine is not. In the end, it's a corny, old-fashioned crowd-pleaser whose real theme is the way David triumphs over his madness, redeeming his life through music and the love of a good woman, a daffy New Ager played by Lynn Redgrave. Inspirational yarns like this can easily become shameless. Just think about Mr. Holland's Opus. But director Scott Hitz tells this story with compelling directness and verve. Beautifully shot, edited like music, and remarkable in its handling of sound, Shine roars along like a freight train. And it never loses its human dimension, thanks to the three performers who play David. 7-year-old Alex Rafalkovich, the sympathetic young actor Noah Taylor, and stage veteran Jeffrey Rush, whose pyrotechnically spastic turn as the grown-up David is sort of like Rain Man after 1,000 cups of coffee. Rush's performance is something of a brilliantly executed stunt, and it hints at Shine's limitations. This is a movie that raises fascinating questions about families, genius, schizophrenia, and even the enduring legacy of the Holocaust, but doesn't slow down to address any of them. It goes for easy emotions that wow you as you're watching, but have little lasting resonance. Which is why, 10 minutes after that screening in Sundance, the sobbing agents had dried their eyes and were heading off to the ski slopes.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. John Lithgow is up for an Emmy for his role in the sitcom Third Rock from the Sun. Yesterday, the show was nominated for a Golden Globe Award. John Lithgow made his movie breakthrough wearing nail polish, eyelashes, prosthetic breasts, and support hose. His portrayal of the transsexual in The World According to Garp earned him an Academy Award nomination. His other film roles include The Panicked Airline Passenger in Twilight Zone the Movie, The Shy Banker in Terms of Endearment, The Psychopathic Murderer in Blowout, and The Fundamentalist Preacher in Footloose. He was also featured in the John Grisham adaptation The Pelican Brief. He starred in the Broadway hit M. Butterfly. Our interview was recorded in 1988.
You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to talk about some of the roles that really first got you noticed in movies.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe play some clips from a few of them and talk about what you did to prepare for them. Would that be okay?
That's fine.
Good. Let's start with the role that I think people really, really noticed you for, and that's in The World According to Garp, when you played the transsexual who had been a linebacker and then through surgery became a woman, and Roberto Muldoon was the character's name. Let's hear a clip from that movie.
Sure you can stay?
No, I have to go have a heartbreak in Manhattan. He's young, he's handsome. Oh, what can I do?
Maybe this time it'll work out.
Maybe so. I'm a hopeless romantic in a male chauvinist world. Bye, darlings!
What were, that's a really great scene, great performance. What were some of the gender questions you had to think about playing a man who had become a woman?
Well, I suppose I had to imagine myself going through all that. Playing Roberta, everybody's always figured that this was the hardest thing I'd ever done. In fact, it was one of the easiest. Roberta Muldoon is, I always approached the character as a very simple and ordinary person who, in fact, was more at home with herself than she had been before her sex change operation. I decided on the basis of not really much research, but just thinking about it, that if I myself were to change myself into a woman, I wouldn't be all that different. There's a big difference between transsexuals and transvestites. Transvestites are crazy about all the affectations of femininity, but transsexuals are very down to earth. They're very ordinary. They're not that different from the way they were before. Just a little more contented. At least that was my approach to Roberta. I had done a lot of unwitting research years before. I'd just been kind of captivated by Jan Morris.
The writer and transsexual.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Had seen her interviewed quite often, had read her memoir, Conundrum, which really recorded the whole process of undergoing this change and all her thoughts before and afterwards. So just inadvertently, I knew a lot about this issue. It came in handy when I screen tested with George Roy Hill, because the screen test was nothing more than a conversation on the subject of my history in the character of Roberta Muldoon.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You once said that playing this character was like conducting a prolonged illicit affair with yourself. It was pretty funny.
Well, it was a sexy experience for sure. I don't know, I was in drag for 3 months, and it's a very provocative experience. I recommend it to everyone.
Why?
It just sort of expands your consciousness. What can I tell you? It was very exciting. You felt like a spy behind enemy lines. I hung out with women all the time, and I felt very secret, like this secret heterosexual, a fox among the pigeons.
You know, another thing I find very interesting about this role is that, you know, you're a very tall man, and the character is a former football player, but the character is very emotionally vulnerable. Now, I think in our culture we associate physical strength with emotional strength, and you had to have physical strength but emotional vulnerability in the role.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was this blend of male and female. I think that's true. George himself, the director, had a lot of qualms about casting me in the role because I was so big. And I always thought that was my greatest asset in the role. It sort of was automatically hilarious and moving all at the same time.
Let's go on to another role. My guest is actor John Lithgow. And I'm sure you also remember him in the movie anthology of The Twilight Zone, where he played a passenger on a plane who was terrified, absolutely terrified of flying. And here he is on a plane that's trapped in a storm. He looks out the window, and he thinks he sees a little monster on the wing putting out one of the engines. A pilot comes and tries to calm him down.
Either calm down, or we're going to handcuff you.
Listen, there's something wrong with this airplane. I don't care what happens to me, but if somebody doesn't do something about it, we're all going to die. That's D-I-E, die!
You Molly.
Sit down, darling. Come on, okay?
Valentine, what do you think's wrong with this aircraft?
There's an engine out.
Which one?
The one on the outside. Outboard number one. It's out, isn't it?
What did you think about to get that out of control, to get that panicking?
This is great. I got to see these movies again.
I had so much fun watching them all again.
Well, I haven't seen them in years. I just sort of worked myself into a state physically. It was a very intense, like, 10-day shoot. So day to day, I was my voice was all raw and I was a physical wreck. And I just kind of exploited that. My research for this part was sort of twofold. I have a very good friend, another actor, who is very afraid of flying, and I always knew that, but I'd never known the details of it, and I phoned him long distance in New York and just asked him to talk about it and answered questions, and he told me the most extraordinary things, almost all of which I managed to physicalize and put into that performance. Just as an example, he said, in an airplane, he's very conscious as he walks down the aisle when it's up in the air not to put too much weight on one side or the other because he's afraid he'll flip the plane over, which sounds hilarious to us, and he knows it's absurd. But yet he walks like a tightrope down that aisle. And if you see the movie again, that's just how I chose to walk. And there was also a remarkable woman, who teaches flight attendants, and she was there as a consultant all the time. And everything I did, I would ask her, am I going too far? And she said, never, never, never. She said, this is nothing to what I have seen.
You know, watching your performance in that film again really made me think about what a very plastic face you have. You can really just totally manipulate your face.
I do have a plastic face, as a matter of fact. No, not really.
No, well, but you can make your eyes pop. You can do things with your cheeks. And,
well, everybody can. I'm the only one who has the nerve.
I want to ask you one other thing about the Twilight Zone movie. In one of the episodes that you weren't in and that you had nothing to do with, there was a terrible accident that we all remember. Vic Morrow and two children were killed in a helicopter bombing accident. Did that really shake you up? Not only the deaths, the tragic deaths of these people, but really like knowing that making make-believe can have tragic real-life consequences.
Well, it was awful, and it was always like a shadow cast over that whole project, even though it was virtually a separate film that happened 2 months before we worked on it.
Oh, that was before your...
Oh, long before, yeah. They were even considering scrapping the whole project, but then they picked it all up again with an entirely new crew. But, you know, we never quite forgot that this terrible thing had happened.
My guest is John Lithgow. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
John Lithgow is my guest. I want to play another role that helped make you famous, and this
great.
Is from...
Great, this is a lot of fun.
Now, this is from Terms of Endearment, where you played a bank officer who's very shy and very straight, and he's beginning an affair with the character played by Deborah Winger.
Emma, I haven't made love to a woman in almost 3 years.
How come?
My wife has a disc problem. And she can't take having any weight on her.
Sam, I hope you don't mind me asking you this, but have you ever thought of your wife getting on top?
Oh, she wouldn't do that.
She may surprise you.
No, I don't think so. It would be so unlike her.
Did you ask?
About 600 times.
That's a great scene. I love the way you speak in that scene. You have this very quiet and unsure speaking style in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And a very slight, I don't know, Midwestern accent?
Yeah. Yeah, well, he was supposed to be a Hawkeye, you know, and I'm a Buckeye, so I just sort of looked back into my past.
Was it easy to kind of get that insecurity?
Oh, effortless in my case.
Not a big stretch, huh?
No. It was an interesting experience because I was really hurled into it. It was a case of recasting. They called me in, you know, like with a day's notice. I learned my words for that part on a jet plane, a private Paramount jet flying out to Nebraska in the middle of the night. And, you know, 12 hours later, I was playing the part with Deborah. There was absolutely no preparation, so insecurity was part of the bargain.
Oh, so you mean in this role, the insecurity was especially evident.
Yeah.
You know, you also in that performance captured the gratitude that this character would feel for Deborah Winger for allowing herself to have this affair with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was an interesting way of interpreting it.
Well, it's all there in the writing. I mean,
mm-hmm,
it's beautifully written that way. I mean, that was indeed my approach. I listening to it just now, this is such a memory lane for me. But that scene is so hilarious and so touching all at the same time.
It is very touching, that's right.
And I think that's Jim Brooks' particular genius, but it's also the kind of acting that I'm very fond of, where at any given moment, a scene can just sort of tip one way or the other.
Well, you see, that I think that really is part of your gift in Twilight Zone, too. I mean, you're really panicking, watching this character panicking, but it's also funny.
Yeah, that's right.
But you really play it both ways.
And that's the charge, is finding that little moment where you can pull the string one way or the other, make them laugh in the middle of panic or cry in the middle of laughter, you know, just surprise them.
It seems to me that a lot of roles that you've gotten are the kinds of roles that wouldn't be offered the kind of actors who look like models. Do you know who have that, mm-hmm, that kind of the perfect good looks of whatever the period is?
Yeah.
Have you ever wanted those kinds of like perfect looks? Or do you think that that's really been a good break in a lot of ways because it enables you to play really interesting roles?
Well, I think it's a good break. I mean, I sort of am what I am. I don't regret. I don't much regret not being more handsome. Or I think I'm a very odd assortment of characteristics. It's sort of there's a lot of peculiarities and surprises about my body, my movements, my face, and I've just sort of learned to appreciate that. I'm sort of a surprising person. And, I mean, as soon as I'm acting, I'm a surprising person. And I think the trick for an actor is to get to know himself very well, to get to know what his abilities are, what his both his limitations and his capacities are. And I've found that I've been able to sort of expand my horizons all the time. And I think that's just because I'm kind of an odd, eccentric person in physically and in other ways.
John Lithgow, recorded in 1988, he's nominated for an Emmy for his role in the sitcom Third Rock from the Sun. Coming up, we remember astronomer Carl Sagan. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Astronomer Carl Sagan died today after fighting bone marrow disease for 2 years. Through his public TV programs and his books, Carl Sagan explained difficult concepts about science and astronomy to millions of Americans. In 1980, his series Cosmos became the most watched limited series in the history of public television. Sagan consulted to NASA on the Mariner, Viking, and Voyager planetary expeditions. In 1982, he was part of a small group of scientists who hypothesized that a nuclear war could have a catastrophic chilling effect on Earth that could end civilization as we know it. They described the scenario as nuclear winter. Sagan had little patience for pseudoscience and superstitions, which he debunked in his most recent book, The Demon-Haunted World. I spoke with him last May after its publication. He had a bone marrow transplant the year before and was feeling good and optimistic when we spoke. I asked if he found himself relying on faith in science or religious faith during the periods he was very ill.
What saved me is, first of all, the cutting edge of medical science. As my wife Annie said, I was riding the crest of medical research, in the sense that had I gotten this disease just 3 or 4 years early, I would probably be dead. So it certainly underscored for me the personal importance of scientific research. And then secondly is the loving care of my family, especially Annie, who in many ways, both metaphorical and literal, saved my life. So that's what I think about in thinking back on my illness. And no, I never had a near-death experience. I was never tempted to abandon skepticism and believe something without adequate evidence just because I was in emotional need.
So where do you turn for answers to those nagging questions like, what is life about? What am I doing here?
I have a tolerance for ambiguity. It's clear to me that there are some questions that humans don't have the answers to, and what arrogance to imagine that we have answers to all questions. See, science is sometimes, I know, attacked for supposed arrogance, but I think it's the most humble occupation and discipline around, because instead of trying to impose our preconceptions, our predispositions on the universe, we are open before the universe to see what the universe has to offer. Science is in the business of finding out what's true, to the extent humans are capable of that, whereas a lot of these other disciplines are in the business of pretending that what feels good is true.
Do you think that science and religion are compatible?
It depends very much on how you view the arena of religion. If I look at the Bible, I see, especially in the King James translation, great literature, great poetry. I see some powerful ethical and moral prescriptions, including the importance of charity. I also see some dreadful stuff, including mass murder of whole people with God cheering one side on. I see rituals and a sense of community, a lot of things that are really terrific, and I'm absolutely for them, and it's hard to see how science could be opposed. But the Bible is not a work of science. The science in the Bible was taken by the Jews from the best scientists of 600 B.C. during the Babylonian captivity of the Jews. But we've learned a lot of science since. So mainstream Roman Catholics and Reformed Jews and most of the mainstream Protestant denominations have no difficulty at all with the evolution of human beings from other animals, an Earth that's 4.6 billion years old, the Big Bang, and so on. But on the other hand, if you are a biblical literalist, then you have problems on the boundaries of science and religion.
Are you a religious man yourself?
I think it's impossible to be a scientist and to confront, even occasionally, the grandeur, subtlety, elegance, and magnificence of the universe without feeling a sense of reverence and awe. But that's very different from concluding that there's a God who issues punishments and rewards after you're dead, or that prayer works, or that the Bible is written by anybody but fallible human beings.
So that means that you have, that you're in awe of the universe, that there's something, what, something larger than any of us, but you wouldn't define it as God.
First of all, you can be religious without believing in God. Mm-hmm. Buddhists are certainly religious without having any notion of God. Secondly, the word God, it's amazing how diverse the definitions are. Let me give two extremes. One is the sort of God that I gathered by osmosis during my childhood, which is an outsized white male who sit with a long white beard who sits on a throne in the sky and tallies the fall of every sparrow. Now, that kind of anthropocentric God, there is, as far as I can tell, no compelling evidence for at all, none. At the other extreme, there's the kind of God that Einstein and Spinoza talked about, not too different from the sum total of the laws of nature. Now, there are laws of nature, and not only that, they apply everywhere to a quasar 10 billion light years away as to the eastern seaboard of the United States. And it's a very remarkable fact that the same laws do apply so generally. It could have been that a different set of laws applies in every county. So that kind of God, of course, exists. Who would deny that there are laws of nature? So I claim you learn absolutely nothing about someone's belief if you ask them, do you believe in God, and they say yes or no. You have to specify which of the countless kinds of God you have in mind. I don't myself like to use the word in that context because it doesn't illuminate at all. If I say I believe in God, or if I say I don't believe in God, and I say no more, you've learned nothing about what my belief system is.
Carl Sagan, recorded last May. He died today of bone marrow disease at the age of 62. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Joyce Lieberman, Fred Snyder, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. On the next Fresh Air, director Milos Forman tells us why he declined and then agreed to direct the new film The People vs. Larry Flint. Also, we meet Peter Gomes, minister at Harvard University's Memorial Church. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.